Well, I suppose the place to start this talk is by mentioning a little bit of the backstory about how Gregory Kulakia and I came to write this little monograph. John had initially suggested that I write something that drew on my doctoral dissertation and a book I wrote on the history of China's nuclear program in order to look at the way in which U.S. and Chinese interests interact in space. And I thought, well, I'd already written that, and actually Gregor and I had just co-authored an article in Nonproliferation Review about the ASAT test. And so it struck me that what we needed was something a little bit different. Because we often, when we think about China and space, we think about it solely as a security problem. And we don't spend a lot of time thinking about the civil interests or how the debate sort of plays out in China. We think of it mostly as a military thing. And just to give you a little example of that, it even happened with the cover, which is to say we end up writing a history about China's space program from the perspective of their civil program. And there was a strong desire to put, you know, some hardware on the cover, like a big missile or something like that. And Gregor and I wanted, like, a picture of Yang Liwei, the first Chinese astronaut, with, like, you know, the Olympic torch or a UN flag. And there's like, no, that stinks. So we ended up settling for a picture of some school children with a paper rocket. So they got their hardware, if only in virtual form. So Gregory, I knew, had done some really amazing work in terms of digging up all of these new historical sources in Chinese about the history of the space program. And there were some really, really remarkable documents. There are some memoirs. There are some commissioned histories. There are some very interesting books written by people who seem to know an awful lot but are writing under pseudonyms. And in some cases, there are even people's papers. The personal papers, letters, and whatnot that offer a contemporary historical record. And what we sought to do was to take that information, do our best to distill it, compare it against the historical technical information. I mean, we know when the satellites went up, so you can get some sense of the reliability of a source. And really tried to present what would be reflective of how the Chinese view what they have tried to do since the late 1950s in space. And I should note that Joan Johnson Fries, who is here, wrote a wonderful book on the history of the Chinese space program. And there have been several wonderful histories, and they really focused on literally what the Chinese have done in terms of what they've put up. And what we tried to do is reconstruct the decision-making from their perspective. What were the things that they were worried about? What were the concerns that they had? Now, that's a pretty big task, and I should note that we did not endeavor to do a comprehensive history of the Chinese space program. We simply looked at three case studies that we thought were particularly revealing about how decisions have been made since the late 1950s. We looked at the launch of the first satellite, which happened in 1970, the launch of the first geostationary satellite, which, if memory serves me right, happened in 1984, and then the launch of the Shenzhou mission. I will not take you on a baton death march of the last 50 years of the Chinese space program. I'm just going to go through and make some very, very preliminary notes about some of the cases and then share with you some of our overall observations. I should also note that, as I say, we did not endeavor to do a comprehensive history of the program. This really is a first draft. It is unbelievable how much unexploited material is out there. And it would not surprise you that not all of the material is consistent and that, you know, just like in the United States, people are vain and self-serving and they have bureaucratic interests. And, you know, Chinese politics, particularly in the late 1960s, was pretty rough. So some people still think other people got other people killed. So there is a lot of historical work left to be done. And so we don't have any kind of arrogance about all the stuff we've dug up. I mean, we feel like we hit a treasure trove and, you know, this is the first box of it, but other people are going to have to come and cart stuff back. It is really interesting, though, to look at these three decisions because it does give you a flavor of how the Chinese have had to make these decisions and the sort of investment and effort that went into the Chinese space program. the Chinese space program really kicks off in 1957 when the Soviet Union puts up Sputnik. This happens shortly before Mao is in Moscow to meet with Khrushchev, who he didn't particularly like. Apparently, Mao finds out about the satellite not too long before he arrives. And when he gets off the airplane, he makes some extemporaneous remarks talking about what a fantastic achievement Sputnik is. I mean, it really made an impression on the senior-most leader, and that is initially the genesis of the Chinese program. And there's a formal decision made in 1958. And it's a very funny thing. We mentioned it in here. When Mao sort of says, I want to put a satellite in orbit, and they go over kind of the technical parameters of what that would take and what that satellite would look like, it was explained to Mao this would be a relatively small thing that was put up there. And Mao was apparently enraged by this and told them he wanted to put up a 2-ton satellite because he'd be embarrassed to put a chicken egg like the Americans did up in orbit. So you think we have problems with space acquisitions here. What's very interesting about the first satellite, it is an incredibly ambitious program. They plan to put all kinds of bells and whistles on the first satellite. But between the chaos of the Great Leap Forward in the late 1950s and the Cultural Revolution in the late 1960s, by the time the satellite actually goes up in 1970, it is completely stripped down. And its only mission is to be seen and heard. It can just play like a little song, and really the demonstration, the effect of the satellite is now, it's gone from a scientific endeavor to an entirely political endeavor. And there's a kind of nice coda, maybe, that shows you how much the politics had replaced the science. At the end of, when they're going to launch the satellite, the weather is terrible, and the scientists want to wait a few more days for the weather to clear to launch the satellite. And Zhou Enlai's like, no, I got a meeting in Hanoi, and you need to get that thing up so that, I have something to talk about. So they launched it in the bad weather. And then the chaos sort of the Cultural Revolution took over. The second case study talks about the decision to launch the first geostationary satellite. And this was a decision that has its roots in 1974 as both Zhou Enlai, the premier of China, and Mao Zedong are dying. It's one of these Chinese stories that's almost too good to be true, so I will be interested to see how future historians treat this. But the story goes that there are three telegraph workers who realize that the ITU allocates orbital slots and that these things are starting to fill up and China doesn't have one. And so what they want to push China to do is to claim a slot, and you've got to sort of announce that you're going to put a satellite in it, and that is kind of the genesis of that program. But it sort of falters until Deng Xiaoping consolidates control in the late 1970s, and he gets taken with the idea of a communication satellite in geostationary orbit for the strangest of reasons, which is he's interested in distance education. They don't have a lot of teachers. You want to be able to build a broadcast network through China. That's actually a really complicated thing, but you could just stick one satellite up there. And this begins a very interesting process. So they've claimed the slot. They've announced they're going to build the satellite. Deng Xiaoping doesn't want to wait, and so he tries to buy it from the United States. And we don't know a whole lot about this interaction, and we've tried to talk to people who are involved, and we haven't gotten the full story, but it seems like there is some foot dragging someplace. And eventually the Chinese get fed up and decide to put their own up. And the first one they put up doesn't work, so they declare it a success and call it an experimental satellite. And then not too after, they put up the second one. And then the final case study looks at the Shenzhou program, which is the manned spaceflight program. And it's worth noting that this dates very far back, to the mid-1960s, which I think early on I said that people were quite ambitious. Chinese folks were talking about space planes and all kinds of things that they had no hope of doing. And one of the things they were pushing for was a space program. And they even had some astronauts selected. But unfortunately, the astronauts were from the Air Force. And so after Lin Biao, Mao's chosen successor, was accused of attempting to plot a coup since his power base was in the Air Force, those guys just got to sit around at a university a couple of years before being dispersed. And the program really doesn't exist. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, even though there are continuing rumors in the West about it. And that's a whole other very interesting story about how those rumors persist, even though the Chinese don't seem to be doing anything. And it's not until Ronald Reagan's 1983 speech on strategic defense that kicks in to drive this huge interest again in China about science and technology. And there's a sense that China is going to be left behind. And so this leads to something you will often hear in defense circles, the 863 plan, which was a high technology plan. Not principally, I think, a military endeavor, but really a sense that China doesn't want to fall behind. And that leads to a resumption of the human spaceflight program. Although, interestingly, they get it approved in 1986, and it takes 5 years to overcome stonewalling in the bureaucracy. And it's not until 1991 that they really honestly begin to implement the decision. And there's a very interesting change of heart that seems to happen with a very senior Chinese military official who claims he was always for it in his memoirs, but it seems very clear that he was a huge obstacle for most people until, and we still don't know why, at some point in 1991, he changes his mind. It's a very interesting reversal that I don't fully understand, although I think some of the ambiguity is captured by Li Peng, who is a senior Chinese figure who is more famous for doing bad things in Tiananmen Square than anything else in the United States. But when he commented on the decision to go forward, I actually want to get the quote right, he indicated that it was a decision that was not necessarily wise, but it had to be done. So, you know, what does all that tell us about China today? Well, I mean, I admit that the past is only a very rough guide to the present. It is very hard for me to imagine Hu Jintao, the current leader of China, you know, screaming about how he's not going to put a chicken egg in orbit. You know, so that is very different. But the past, I think, does help us understand the structure that the Chinese have built and some of the interests at play. And for example, I think that it really explains this thing we always hear, that the PLA runs the Chinese space program. I suppose I should say runs is a word that has no precise bureaucratic meaning. But I think when you look at the history of the program, it does become more clear what runs means. I mean, I think the Chinese military does provide day-to-day management of the program. And it seems quite obvious why. The military consolidated control over the space program in the 1960s because of the chaos of the Cultural Revolution. They had the technical assets, they had the people, they were able to secure money, and most important, they were able to protect scientists who had started off in other bureaucracies from all kinds of turmoil. So one of the most interesting things we have today is you have the PLA in China is probably still, for all of its corruption, the most competent, capable institution in the country. And I think a major challenge for Chinese leaders has been to transition away from that, to build other sources of competence and not to rely on the military for everything. But because the Chinese military provides the day-to-day management of the program, that's not the same thing as saying that the goals and the interests and the reasons for pursuing human spaceflight are in and of themselves military. And I think the thing that we see time and time again in these case studies is that there are other interests. In particular, I do hope you'll all read the monograph. I mean, it's fascinating the degree to which individual policy entrepreneurs, scientists and technical people who have a little bit of a connection in China are able to push things. And they're able to push things against a bureaucracy that doesn't want it. I mean, this case of getting an approval for spaceflight in 1986 and taking 5 years to move a bureaucracy is very indicative of that. And by the way, the way that's done is by having a guy who is Deng Xiaoping's son-in-law hand deliver two letters, one in 86 and one in 91. And it actually takes Deng Xiaoping saying, do this, to get it done. The second thing is, it's really clear to me how little our own discussions about Chinese space policy have to do with the discussions, that the Chinese have had. In the United States, we focus on Qian Shui-sen, who was a Chinese scientist who studied in America and got deported or had to leave, or, I mean, it's a sort of complicated story. But in our discussions, he's often held out as an exemplar of the kind of person or is often held out as sort of the father of the Chinese space program. And it's a lot more complicated than that. He's a cheerleader. He's very well-connected. He's also a little crazy. I mean, for a while, he pushes them to do a space plane when they don't have any hope of doing that. And he doesn't seem to be a terribly nice guy. And so it's, I think, one of the interesting, he comes out as a more full, human, flawed, and very capable figure. And I find that as a cautionary note for sort of our own confidence about what we think happened. But the most important thing, and the thing I want to leave you with, is that there is a single phrase that Chinese tend to use over and over and over and over again to describe why they did this, why they spent all this money, why they went through all this trouble. And I think it's very telling. And the phrase is, a place for one's mat. It's like a seat at the table, but in ancient China, people sat on the floor. So you put a little mat down and you sat on it. John started off our conversation by noting that our space program was born of a great conflict. And I think the dominant metaphor during the Cold War for space was a race, right? And a race is something in which you have a winner. And if you have a winner, you have a loser. That's not the metaphor that the Chinese use, at least internally to themselves, to describe what they're doing. Right? Theirs connotes more this idea of being a member of a club. It's more like getting into the Metropolitan Club. Those of you who may be members or aspiring members. And a corollary of that is the Chinese take their technical cues from the countries that are already members of the club. So I think over and over again, what we see is not so much the Chinese racing as we see them copying. Ronald Reagan gives a speech on SDI. They decide that they need to be doing this too. They have the Soviet Union puts up Sputnik. All of a sudden, Mao's running around screaming about chicken eggs. It's not fundamentally a zero-sum conception so much as it is the idea of joining. And so I will close with this thought, which is, to me, that's a very powerful metaphor, and it suggests that there really is the possibility of cooperation in space. If it's not a zero-sum competition, if the idea is becoming a member of the club and then participating actively in the development of the rules, then I think we do have the opportunity to engage with the Chinese on a constructive basis and try to create the kind of rules in space that protect all of our interests. I think the way we close in the monograph is by saying if all they really want is a place for the mat, I think the rest of us can scoot over a little bit.